Good morning, everyone. Welcome to number 125 of the Fendrian Cast version 2. It was kind of like Snapchat, the first version of episode 125. It seemed to appear, and then some technological issues meant that it then disappeared. And with lots of to-ing and fro-ing with our podcast provider, couldn't get it back. There was some sort of phone version that existed, but anyway, that's gone. That was the episode that talked about the end of the Vuelta and a holiday to the Alps. Now, quite a lot has happened since then. We will kind of skirt back over those couple of important factors and kind of add in the Worlds and the end of the season, if that's okay with everyone. So, looking back now to the end of August to the Vuelta, we left it coming into the final week where Primoz Roglic had looked imperious in the red jersey of race leader. We won't go back over in massive detail because some of you might have heard the original version, but there was the incident towards the end of that final week where Roglic managed to show a bit of vulnerability, got ambushed in a crosswind stage. Quintana was the rider from Movistar who got away in the group up the road, and it kind of compressed the general classification a little bit more than maybe it looked like it would be going into those final 5 days or so of the race. More so than that, there was the penultimate, or the last Friday rather, of the race, so the penultimate racing stage, where Roglic was involved in a crash with James Knox of Quickstep going down. Tony Martin got injured enough to be out of the race. And Movistar started drilling it on the front. And there was a lot of talk at the time, a lot of commentary, a lot of punditry, a lot said and a lot written about the etiquette of what should happen if the race leader is involved in a crash, not of his own making, or a mechanical, not of his own making. And of course, it's the second time this has happened in a way to Roglic this year. Of course, in the Giro, when he was in a position of potential overall victory, he was involved in a mechanical and his team car weren't there and he had to wait for another rider's bike. They pushed on at that point, and that was a combination of teams because it was towards the end of a stage in the Italian lakes where there wasn't a complete set of riders from one single team in control. Whereas this was, in my opinion, clearly premeditated. It was clearly an act of Movistar, maybe not expecting to put him out of the leader's jersey, but maybe trying to weaken him, knowing that there was one more stage in the mountains to follow. But whatever happened, it seemed like the race authorities were happy to let him draft and use a number of other team cars to get back to his position in the peloton. And once Movistar, who'd got one or two other teams handing out a few verbal pelters to them, once they realised, I think, that Roglic was going to get back with the aid of the team cars and the convoy, they knocked it off and obviously came up with the suggestion that they would plan to attack in that little narrow village on that narrow turn anyway. So it was completely coincidental that the race leader was on the day. I think it was pretty poor tactics, pretty badly handled. At the time, we ran a Twitter poll saying, did we feel that Movistar were now the most despicable team in pro cycling ahead of Ineos? Movistar won that poll. So it ended the Vuelta on a slightly contentious note. It was fine for Roglic, he hung on. And actually maybe it made his win that little bit more secure, potentially, as a result of that. He had ridden really, really well the whole race, didn't show signs of fading as he had in the Vuelta. His issues that he did have were tactical rather than physical. So it was just a really good race, and I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed the Vuelta. Hard to say which of the big tours was the best this year. I mean, I think the Giro and the Vuelta were that step above the Tour de France, primarily because the Tour de France was denied its epic alpine finish because of the terrible weather, the landslides. But the Giro was really exciting in the last week, and the Vuelta also. So, of course, at some point we'll come along to do a full review of the season. Subsequent to that, we had Remco Evenepoel dominating the San Sebastian Classic, which was a fantastic performance. He was dropped earlier on in the race, but found himself at the front and was just too powerful for the others to get on. A rare win for Sepp van Marck in Plouay, the Grand Prix Plouay, where he was tactically superb in the last couple of kilometres before unleashing a semi-attack, semi-sprint to win that. So we were delighted, being big Sepp van Marck fans on this pod. And then we kind of hurtled into the World Championships, which were in Yorkshire, and despite the sort of pre-event controversy surrounding Sir Gary Verity and what he may or may not have done and how that works in terms of the Tour de Yorkshire, the Welcome to Yorkshire organisation, we don't know, do we? We don't know what happens now, but clearly there is a reason why he's been removed, and a lot again was written and a lot was said. I read an article by Richard Moore about, you know, the impact, and people saying that actually the promised wealth that was supposedly going to come to Yorkshire as a result of hosting cycling events hasn't materialised. Who knows? Who knows where this puts the sporting landscape? But the World Championships were good. There was, of course, a controversy in the under-23s. A rider who had drafted, a la Roglic at the Vuelta, getting back on after his mechanical. This guy had a crash, also drafted back on. It was about 100-odd k's from the finish. He then went on to win, and was subsequently then disqualified. Now, I understand, you know, with VAR and footage not being available at the time and all of the stuff that goes with that, that's absolutely fine. I mean, having seen bits of the footage, apparently there's over 2 minutes. You know, I don't think there's any danger of him, you know, he did it. It's fairly clear. Was he the only rider in the race who did it? If he'd not got a medal, would he then have not been disqualified? Would the commissaires let it ride? I think drafting and using the convoy, using the team cars, is something that's a really fascinating debating point. The number of cars in the convoy has been highlighted by a number of sources since this incident, saying, you know, we talk about cycling as a green and environmental sport, and there's almost as many cars and motorbikes as there are riders. Now, I accept that there need to be a lot of motorbikes for security, to secure the roads, and secure the event. So that's absolutely, you know, that's absolutely fine. I don't see another way around that. But do all of the team, would it impact the race that much if all of the teams had one team car, or there was a beefed up neutral service? I don't know. There has to be a solution that doesn't necessarily, maybe Flanders have got the right idea. They're using a circuit finish for the Tour of Flanders, or have done for a few years now, which allows them to monetize parts of the circuit with admission, and also means that, you know, there's a circuit area where people can see more than once, but also with that in mind, mechanics, soigneurs can be there to service riders more than once. And, you know, we saw it this weekend in Paris-Tours that there were people with wheels at the end of quite a lot of the gravel sectors. Now, whether they were the same people or different people, they've not arrived by bicycle necessarily. So we just need to think out how we, you know, it's great that the sport has moved on and we've seen a lot of little improvements, just things like riders putting gel wrappers in their pocket rather than just flicking them off into the ditch and littering it. All of those things are great. We just need to think about maybe how that convoy works and how cycling can make itself more environmentally friendly, but not less of a spectacle. The Worlds then itself, aside from that under 23 race, we had the drama of Annemiek van Vleuten dominating the women's race with a real long range attack, 100 k's out. Lizzie Deignan did all that she could. She certainly made the race exciting, made it entertaining before fading off. But having said all of those things, it was a great ride by the Dutch woman, thoroughly deserving of the championships, and showed Yorkshire off. Nice weather and sun shining, big crowds at the side of the road. It was everything that, in the end, sadly, the weather decided that the men's race wouldn't be. The men's race damaged by flooding, that meant the circuit was shortened. I think the overriding image of that race will be of Matthew van der Poel making the race and then just finding that distance, 13 whatever it was, 14 miles too far, and just disintegrating into his shell and just dropping minute after minute after minute in that last part. It was quite something. We've all been there. We've all been there. Anyone who's ridden a bike will have got to the stage where their legs have just ceased operating and they've gone. And so, and certainly no slight on Matthew van der Poel, and certainly not after the season he's had, where he's won Amstel, Dwarsdorf, Vlaanderen, fourth in the Tour of Flanders, numerous cyclocross events, Tour of Britain stages, Tour of Britain. So, he's done well enough. I don't necessarily subscribe to the school of thought that that's his last or his first and last opportunity. He'll have at least another 8 or 9 goes at it. And at some point, a circuit will come up that will suit him. At the moment, any circuit seems to suit him. And that's fantastic for the sport to have such a dominant rider out there. I'm looking forward to him versus Wout van Aert in the classics in the coming seasons. It'll be great to watch, that's for sure. Speaking of classics, they kind of rounded out this weekend. We had the week of Italian semi-classics last week with like the Bruno Beghelli and the Tour of Piedmont, and it was nice to see Primoz Roglic win on the same hill that he'd won the first time trial of the Giro on. Some great racing, actually. Nice to see Egan Bernal get the Ineos jersey off the front and get a win. Michael Woods got a win. Everything was kind of set up nicely for the Giro of Lombardia, or Il Lombardia as it's now called, and that didn't disappoint either. Fabulous action from start to finish. Love it when they go past the chapel, the Madonna de Giazzolo, where the bells are always pealing and sound amazing. Fantastic attack there by Tom Scoinge. Giulio Ciccone was in the action. Everything was brilliant. And Trek, who got a world champion in Mads Pedersen, who not many people would have backed, but I certainly feel he could be a rider to do justice to the jersey. He's certainly a hard man for the classics. They now can't stop winning, and having been one of the worst teams in the World Tour for 80% of the season, and Richie Porte didn't really achieve a great amount of the Tour de France, for example, they now are struggling to lose a race, and Bauke Mollema would have been on people's list of riders to be there or thereabouts for this race. Wouldn't have been on anyone's list as necessarily the winner, but he attacked, he descended brilliantly, and he kept the pace up on the flat, where you might have thought that his advancing years towards veteran status and his predominance as a climber might mean that he lost, but he got it just right in terms of maybe he got lucky that the group behind wasn't dominated by riders from a single team who would work and hunt him down. You were left with a number of teams that had the odd rider in, and none of them were particularly desperate to close the gap and bring him back, because they feared a counter-attack, or they feared that they might bring him back at the wrong moment, and all of those things that get in the mind when a single rider has just snuck away. And thoroughly deserved by Mollema, absolutely over the moon. Not quite as over the moon as his mum. If you've seen a tweet that was posted by Mollema himself recently, he's rounding the last corner, and there is a lady jumping up and down and waving her fists at him in the road. And he's tweeted the pictures of that and said, yeah, guys, that was my mum. So congratulations to Bauke Mollema's mum as well for becoming a viral internet sensation. After Lombardy, you could be forgiven, potentially, for thinking, right, that's that then. But Paris-Tours, who a race that's come in for a fair bit of stick, is fair to say, over the years, for being a boring flat sprinters classic. Last year there was quite a lot of vitriol directed at it from Quickstep, who never took the start, or didn't take the start, sorry, this year, from their manager Patrick Lefebvre, saying that the gravel tracks through these numerous vineyards made the race a folly and a farce. And again, on commentary, Rob Hatch pointed out this weekend that, you know, these are the sort of races that the Quickstep thrive on. They're the sort of races that are in vogue. You look at Trobro-Leon, there's been some Riblon in Paris-Nice a couple of years back. There was a gravel track finish to the Planche de Belfie in the Tour de France, only this summer. I actually think it's carved quite a nice niche out, being as well as being a Belgian beer lover. I do like a wine as well, so for me to see this race pick its way through some of the vineyards to the south of Paris, some of the beautiful chateau, even a few tents set up at the side of the road selling some of their produce, it was great. The gravel sections made the race exciting, not if you were Nicky Terpstra, who had a couple of punctures, but, you know, still got up to finish second. And in Yellow Walleyes, we had a rider who won the old version of Paris-Tours when it was technically a sprinter's classic, although he won it from a breakaway. We had him winning solo, attacking. He was trying to get over to the defending champion Søren Krogh Andersen, but Andersen punctured as Walleyes came across to him, which left him sort of exposed and on the front. And he kind of said in his interview, "I just decided to keep going." No one was able to get across to him. If he hadn't have celebrated so wildly at the finish, he'd have probably still had a minute on the rest of the chasers that was led by home by Nicky Terpstra, as we said. Oliver Naarsen had tried to make the race quite a lot, didn't really contribute to the counter-attack with Terpstra, and respectfully didn't sprint. You never know, he might need that favour back at some point to take third. And then Arnaud Démare was savagely trying to get back across by launching a long-range sprint to try and get on that podium. I thought he was excellent on the day. His team rode really well. They had a couple of punctures at bad times, Groupama. But Arnaud Démare's kind of showing himself as the all-rounder that his Milan-San Remo win seemed to indicate he would be. And he's not seen him lots and lots this year, but when we've seen him, he's been, you know, right on it. And that's good to see. That's what you want to see from your, from the sport's big riders. I think if he decided to target some of the classics, I think potentially he could be a factor. Whether he could get up and over the hills of Flanders, maybe the slightly less torturous climbing of like a Gent-Wevelgem might suit him. We shall see. But it was a fabulous race, and maybe made better by the fact that no one necessarily expected that much. There had been plenty of criticism, plenty of negativity about the change in format to the race. But does it mean that gravel racing or gravel tracks are here to stay? Does it mean that you know, the sport has definitely made a change towards some of the more off-road things? Maybe, hopefully, because, you know, it was exciting. I think the other thing to kind of say with that is that the gravel fad, in its wider sense, has been picked up well by EF. You know, they've had Lachlan Morton's done the GP Giro, the end-to-end gravel ride. He's done the Three Peaks. Maybe in this country, with the density of volume of traffic on the road, we are going to have to think about using a mix of road and tracks, shared access tracks where applicable, to ensure that we can still go racing. I know my club was looking at potentially doing a gravel event this year, and fortunately, I think there were some technicalities with bridleways, don't quote me on that, but that meant potentially that that wasn't going to happen when it, you know, could and should have happened maybe. So there are ways and means, but there are also challenges and issues that need to be resolved before all of these things can happen. And the final thing that I would like to cover again that was in the original 125 episode that went was some cycling in the Alps. And you may have seen the pictures on the website, on the socials of that glorious couple of days or a few days in the Alps. It was hot, believe it or not, when it's like 8 degrees in the team car today, but it was hot. Couple of days riding, stayed on the Col d'Ornon, the village of Ornon, tiny little place with like 9 or 10 houses. It branches off the actual col, just for those of you that know it, just before the bridge that's about halfway up probably, and it's really, really tough getting back to the actual village. You go from Lapalud up this really steep, it's probably only about 4 switchbacks and about 2 kilometres, but it kind of doesn't dip really much below 10%, and having got Alpe d'Huez in my legs earlier on that day, it actually felt probably harder. So, but I can heartily recommend it. And if you go on past the village of Ornon for another 2 or 3 switchbacks, if you really, really want to, there's a nice little lake and an area where there's parking and all of the sort of mod cons, apart from a Costas. But you don't see those in France anyway. So it was first day down the Col d'Ornon. I have to say that as I get older, my descending prowess seems to be less Vincenzo Nibali and more Thibaut Pinot circa 2016. Having gone from, you know, like an everyday bike with disc brakes back to my lightest road bike with rim brakes, you know, it certainly felt a challenge. It was quite early morning as well to try and beat the traffic on Alpe d'Huez, and so it was reasonably chilly. I was pretty cold by the time I got to the bottom, and my braking fingers were pretty stiff. But I pressed on through Bourg d'Oisans, the standard route, the famous route that, of course, people know through the town, and then over the roundabout, and often up Alpe d'Huez by the standard route. I've been up it before, so I kind of remembered bits and bobs of it. I love the sound of the fountains, the melt water coming down. I love the fact that, you know, it's so hard. The first sort of kilometre and a half, it does settle down the gradient, and you can kind of pick your rhythm. I kind of picked the wrong day. I went up it on a Friday, which once you get to the end of like the Strava segment and where the podium and the inflatable man are, and the actual Tour de France finish is a couple of hairpins, probably even 2Ks further on. So I pressed on with that, having to ride round the village, round the market that had set up for the day on the Friday, and then up to the Tour de France finish before getting further up to make sure I made the 2,000 metre marker before dropping back down, which was really good. And again, lovely for you know, the end of the summer, and for in a mountain resort where there was still quite a lot of people around on bikes and in cars and enjoying the mountain and the fresh air. Food was fairly reasonable at the top of Alpe d'Huez if you go to the little caf that's opposite the Cycle Huez bike shop. So get yourself up there if you're in, and I think maybe, to be fair, the amount of effort that I'd made, any food would have probably gone in fairly quickly and effectively. But, you know, it's top panini. And they seem to have, I don't know what it is about being on holiday abroad, but the Coke always seems to be that little bit cooler. Possibly. And then back down, and then back up the Ornon via the challenging little finish to Lapalud. The second day of riding, I took in the Glandon and the Croix de Fer. Very difficult climbs for a whole set of different reasons. Where you get a reasonable, consistent gradient on Alpe d'Huez, you get none of that on the Glandon or the Croix de Fer. You get a lot of up and down. There's some really steep descents. Really steep descents that then followed by like sort of switchbacks that scrub all of your speed off before you get into like an 11-12% section. I have to say I was all over the place. But I knew that after that, I was going to spend the next week of the holiday just chilling out and swimming and relaxing and stuff with the wife and kids. So despite saying a couple of times when they passed me in the car that I was probably not going to make it, I made it. The Glandon, once you got to the Glandon, it was great. I could sprint up. There was a lot of gendarmes about. I wondered whether because it was a Sunday, they do marshal the climb, because there was a lot of cyclists, a lot of motorbikes, a lot of cars. But then getting towards the top of the Croix de Fer, the last couple of kilometres up there, I saw even more gendarmes and, interestingly, some barriers, lots of people. I thought, wow, there's a lot of people come out to watch me stagger my way up an Alp. It transpired the Tour de l'Avenir, the under-23 Tour de France was coming through. And that was really good because it certainly focused my mind. I had to really work at getting myself up there really hard. And once I'd got to the top, I'd managed to escape the race, so I managed to sit in the calf at the top and enjoy a nice relaxing Orangina and watch the race go by, cheer on the Brits, before thinking, right, I'm packing my bike in the car. That is season 2019 done. I've done all the time trials I can do. I've done all of the other stuff that I can possibly be interested in. Now is the time for a little break. And I've had that 3-week break, started training again. But, you know, it's kind of not that serious, and getting out there to enjoy it, believe it or not, even in this weather. I could heartily recommend nipping over to the Alps and doing a ride. Quite a long way, 9 and a bit hours in the car. So it was a bit of a marathon. There was the usual kerfuffle at Eurotunnel coming back. We kind of went on a Tuesday night about 9 o'clock, camped in the car once we got to France, and then drove down. Whereas coming back, we had to get like a Saturday afternoon shuttle, and you know, there was queues and holding pens and all manner of stuff going on that you don't really particularly want when you just want to get home. Since then, it's been the end of the season, really. Now, you know, we had this episode go up once and disappear. Let's hope that we can get through without any technicalities this time, mainly because it's very difficult motivationally to keep recording a podcast and it disappearing. So, you know, in terms of morale and motivation, I just want to get it to get up there, get it to stick, and then we'll hopefully get back to some level of normality where, you know, we can do the pod regularly and know that it's going to be up there and exist. That's my plan anyway. So thank you very much for listening, everyone. It's been epic. Been a longer one than usual this time. We'll discuss the format potentially next time and see about going back to maybe like a briefer pod every so often, more regularly. But in the meantime, thanks very much for listening, sharing. Enjoy. Thank you very much.